This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 141 was recorded on November 15th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. HedgEye founder Keith McCullough joins me as this week's feature interview guest, and as usual, the HedgEye team put together a fantastic slide deck for us. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email or on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Keith and I will discuss everything from equity markets to the U.S. dollar to treasury yields. I'm also pleased to announce the publication of my own first book, Beyond Blockchain, The Death of the Dollar and the Rise of Digital Currency. So be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview when Patrick and I will discuss what the book is about and what it predicts. We're also releasing the first chapter of the audiobook version as a free sample for Macro Voices listeners. You should already have it in your iTunes feed by the time you hear this podcast.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, what a change from last week on the S&P 500. When we were recording last week, the S&P was more or less near 2,800, and we were asking how high does it go? And suddenly, after almost 3, 4, 5 days of selling, everyone is asking the question, is it a here-we-go-again moment? What's your take on that?
Well, I guess if you're looking for the bullish argument, which a lot of people seem to be reaching for, and I stress reaching for, you could say that maybe there is a right shoulder forming on an inverse head and shoulders pattern on the chart. Frankly, I think that's one of those head and shoulders that are in the eyes of the desperate as opposed to really there in the chart. It would be a fairly lopsided head and shoulders. And frankly, we haven't really seen enough action to say that a right shoulder is forming. So I don't know where we're headed from here. My general disposition is I will be very surprised if we see new highs this year. I won't be at all surprised if the top is in for the bull market. In fact, that is my strong leaning, is that the high is in for the bull market and that it's downhill from here. I have to be honest, though, and throw in the caveat that there have been several times in the last few years that I thought that should have been the case, and I was proven wrong as the market continued to press to even higher highs. So as I said last week, I'll be astonished if we get to 3,000 on the S&P. Doesn't mean it isn't possible, though. My guess is that we rally from here. I'm very curious to know your view, Patrick. I'm thinking at this point we'll be lucky to see 2820 or whatever we were looking at last week. Last week we thought maybe we were headed higher. As you said, I think in last week's program, maybe that was it. And Patrick, I know that you totally nailed it in your morning webinar today on Thursday when you got your members in right at the bottom on a tactical buy using an option to protect your downside. Now, for anybody who doesn't believe us, because that's 50 points of profit that you've made today alone, just grab a free trial to Big Picture Trading and you can listen to this morning's webinar yourself. It certainly was a very, very prescient call. Have you turned bullish, Patrick, or are you thinking, as I am, that we'll be lucky to get back to where we were last week before we turn lower again?
First of all, I'm completely in your camp. I think the highs of the year are in. And though I don't think it's just a straight line move down. And there's going to be multiple times where this market will do substantial fake out moves. And what's amazing is that a fake out move can easily be 100 to 200 S&P point swings either direction. So it's going to be, in my mind, a rather noisy event here. Overall, if I was to say over the next 2-3 weeks where the market will be, I feel it will likely be a little higher than where we are, but I don't think we're going to like new highs or anything like that. But I'm quite bearish into 2019. So it's sort of about the tactical play here as to looking for some short-term upside and then to kind of seeing where it takes us and then seeing where the next real moment to go short the market again will emerge. But right now, we're temporarily long. Let's see where this goes.
I got to hand it to you for that call, but I'm curious, what was that based on? Because you did tell your members that you thought it was bottoming. That was a fib level? That was a measured move? How did you know that that was going to be the bottom, or at least there was a good chance that it was going to be the bottom?
Yeah, we predominantly use Fibonacci analysis and looking for the ebb and flow movement of these different moves. And so we used that kind of a technique to do this one in this case. Nonetheless, let's move on to the dollar. And one of the things that we've seen, obviously, in the last week was a dollar breakout. And when that dollar breakout started happening, I was, even to my members, saying that we got to take it easy. One day does not make a new trend. What I always say is that I want to see how it behaves in the days after the breakout, which really tells you what's on the mind of traders rather than the breakout itself. So far, the dollar index is actually holding up along the highs, which at least on the, for the few days that we've been watching this, is at least somewhat encouraging for a bull breakout. That's certainly going to drive potentially a risk off kind of environment for a lot of the counter assets. But what's your take here? Are you still bigger picture bullish here, the dollar?
Yeah, I'm still dollar bullish for sure, and very similar view to yours, except what I would say is I'm very much convinced that this surge up that we saw in the dollar, that bull breakout, was really news-driven, and it had to do with the whole Brexit politics in the UK, and they're basically having a revolt there among the Brexiteers. So the pound sterling has been dumping against the dollar, and that accounted for the strength. When I saw that, I thought, boy, the big test here is not what happened. The question is, are we going to fully retrace or are we going to hold this? And so far, we're basically holding it. What did it top out at 97 spots, 50 something? And we're just teetering just barely below 97 even. So half a point down. Considering where we've been just a week ago, a full big handle lower at 96, I think the fact that we're still holding here, even as that news effect fades, is very bullish. So, you know, each time we move higher, we're finding higher levels of support, and I think it's a continued move up from here.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil because, wow, what a drop. I've been myself kind of saying that this is oversold, it can't go that much further, and then it surprises again and again how low it can go. It looks like we've hit some sort of at least short-term floor around the 55 handle, and we're bouncing off of that, but there's really no motivation in taking oil in some sort of a dead cat bounce off the low. We're still just trading around 56.50 level as we speak. Is there room for oil to bounce here? What's your take on this?
Well, it's complicated, so let's go over all the things that led to this. First of all, the sell-off that really exacerbated on Tuesday was a result of the news that nobody could see coming, which was that Saudi Arabia had increased production. Now, I know our Macro Voices listeners are paying attention. You remember me 2 weeks ago on this program saying, nobody's getting it. Khalid Al-Falli just said they're pedaling as fast as they can. They're producing as much oil as they possibly can. That was really newsworthy, and people didn't take it to heart the way they should have. Now they're all acting surprised when the data came out that Al-Falli meant what he said, and they had increased production. What a shocker. What's very interesting, though, to me is that still had the effect of, oh boy, additional production, additional exports from Saudi Arabia. There's too much oil. Prices straight down, 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 down. And we got to that 54 spot 75 level, which was the low print on Tuesday. I think that's at least a temporary exhaustion level. A news article that's gotten quite a bit of attention from CNBC has posited the theory that President Donald Art of the Deal Trump brilliantly architected this ruse to trick the OPEC ministers in Saudi Arabia in particular into increasing production by intentionally signaling that there would be a very strict imposition of sanctions on Iran and encouraging other oil producers that they had to make up for Iranian production that was coming offline by increasing their production to compensate, and then the old switcheroo. I was just kidding. We're not really going to be that strict about enforcing those Iran sanctions. We're going to grant a whole bunch of exemptions and allow the price to continue to move down. So they're giving President Trump credit for supposedly snookering the Saudis and tricking them. Frankly, I don't know whether or not that really happened that way or if the circumstances just happened to play out that way. I would not be impressed with the president's negotiating talent if that were really the case, because they'll remember next time and they won't fall for that one again. But in any case, that news story got a lot of attention. And I think the really big story has been inventory, because we had expectations of about a 3 million barrel build on inventory. When we had API come out on, everything is delayed this week by a day because of the holiday. So API came out on Wednesday afternoon with a 8-point-something million barrel build, and everybody just couldn't believe it was really going to be that big of a number. Then the EIA data came out Thursday morning with a 10.3 million barrel build on national crude oil inventory. That's against a 3.1 million barrel consensus expectation. So massive, massive, massive. Massive build should be super, super bearish news, but we didn't really see the market sell off dramatically after that. Now, it is true that that big build in inventory was offset. There was also a 1.2 million barrel build in Cushing, Oklahoma, so we're continuing to see restocking in Cushing. Gasoline and distillates both drawing down, 1.4 million on gasoline, 3.6 million barrel drawdown on distillates. Even if you add those together and look at the net drawdown in finished products of 5 million barrels, it's still half of the crude oil build. So this massive surprise build did not result in a further shock to the downside. And that really is an indication that maybe the selling has reached an exhaustion level. On the other hand, we haven't seen the reversal to the upside really take off with a whole lot of enthusiasm. We've seen the prices bounce, kind of feeling dead cat bouncy, but not really turning lower, and it didn't turn lower on inventory. The other thing about inventory, remember the discussion we had last week about that production figure moving up 400,000 barrels in a single week, all the way up to a record level of 11.6 million barrels last week. And I said, boy, with a move that big, it's highly suspect. Don't be surprised if there's a retracement next week. What happened? The exact opposite. Another move to a new record high of 11.7 million barrels, an additional 100,000 barrels of U.S. production. So we're seeing super bearish inventory data, both in terms of the inventory build and the production data, and yet still, and there's also an SPR release of 1.4 million barrels, still we're not seeing new lower lows below what we hit on Tuesday when that news came out about Saudi production doing exactly what Khalid Al-Falih told us it was going to do 2 weeks ago on network television, but nobody was paying attention. So, you know, it seems to me like the market's trying to decide, okay, are we reaching an exhaustion point where it's time to bounce seriously, or is it just dead cat bounce for a few days and then still lower? I'm very curious to know your take, Patrick, as a technician, because what doesn't really jibe for me is I would have thought that either that inventory number would have been the catalyst to take us to a new lower low and more selling, or the market would say, okay, we've reached exhaustion, we're not going to sell anymore. And once we'd had time for that to set in and for the market to absorb the fact that it wasn't going to sell off dramatically, I would have expected buying to really pick up to the upside, for everybody to say, we hit the exhaustion point, that's it, it's over, the bottom is in, it's uphill from here. We're not seeing either of those things. So what's your take as a technician? What is this tape telling you about what might be coming next?
The one thing that we can identify is the extremely oversold state of oil. You know, to use an analogy of an elastic band between two index fingers, you can stretch it apart. When something gets really oversold, often it has a reaction the other way, pulling some sort of a retracement or some mean reversion of that huge sell-off. What's interesting, that never really happened in 2014 and 15 when oil was crashing. That was just almost like a straight line move to the downside, which, you know, asked the question, are we in some sort of a bizarre deja vu of 2014-15? Because if we're not, we are long overdue for some sort of proper bounce in oil. But I mean, there's no guarantees in the market, but on balance, I think fading the selling just on a reaction the other way is the path of least resistance. But by no means would that be me being bullish on oil. Simply, it's just crazy how big of a drop we've seen up until now. But what I do want to ask you about, and I want to move on, earlier this week, there was a number of people talking about, I first got onto it when Kevin Muir, who writes Markets, the Macro Tourist blog, wrote the blog piece called Energy Fund Taken to the Chipper. But then Charlie McElligott also wrote about it later, this idea that some major hedge fund is offside being long crude and short nat gases and getting squeezed on this massive move. Those of our listeners that aren't familiar with what's happening in the natural gas market, there's just been an extraordinary rally of like 50% to the upside in short order. But I wanted to ask you about is one of the things that is speculated out there is that some trader is caught on some sort of a nat gas spread, and the spread is being blown out as they're caught on the wrong side of it. And what Kevin put on his chart there was this spread between the March and April nat gas contracts, where traditionally they throughout the last couple of years that spread's traded in the 25 to 40 cent range, and suddenly we're more than double that range as the spread just completely blows out. And the speculation there is that some trader is stuck on the wrong side of a spread and is taken to the wood chipper. First of all, I'm sure many of our listeners don't understand how spread trading works in the energy markets in general. But what's your take on this? You're usually an oil spread trader this way. What do you see when you see that this story?
Well, this is a fairly sophisticated trade, so it's going to take a minute to explain it. The way that this particular trade works, and it's a very well-known trade, it's a very popular trade with commodity trading advisors and commodity pool operators. And the way it works is very, very similar conceptually to the way people were shorting the VIX until it blew up. And the idea is the reason you're short is not so much that you have a directional view that the price is headed down, but rather because there's so much contango in the market. In other words, each successive contract is priced higher than the one before it. So each time you roll your short position forward by a month, you're capturing that contango as profit. And that's the reason that you want to be short natural gas. Now, the natural gas contract is called the Widowmaker for a reason, which is it tends to have unexpected spikes. Little things can happen. Even in the summertime, you can have an air conditioning spike where there's demand for power, which requires natural gas. The price goes just through the roof. So it's a very, very volatile contract. But if you're going to be systematically short natural gas, you want to hedge that with something that moves in sympathy with natural gas because it's also energy, but which doesn't have that contango characteristic. Now, the reason for the contango in the natural gas contract itself is because of the very high storage cost of natural gas. It has to be compressed and liquefied and chilled to super cold temperatures, and it's a very, very expensive storage process. You don't have that with crude oil. Crude oil just sits in the ground, doesn't have any special storage requirements. So, therefore, if you have a pairs trade where you're short natural gas and long crude oil, you would expect the price of crude oil and the price of natural gas to pretty much balance themselves out. So if you're short the natural gas and you're long the crude oil, if you do it in the right ratios, that's going to be net even. You're not going to make or lose anything because whatever you lose on the natty, you gain on the crude oil or vice versa as the price fluctuates up and down. So if you've got that pairs trade on where you've got the right ratios between natural gas on the short side and crude oil on the long side, you're not making or losing anything as market prices go up and down, but over time you're capturing all of that massive contango yield in the natural gas market as profit, and it's a very, very lucrative trade until something goes wrong. Now, enter what supposedly was Donald Art of the Deal Trump snookering the Saudis. I'm not sure that's really what happened, but one way or another, we have seen a massive, massive move down in oil prices between the Khashoggi murder really putting a lot of question on Saudi Arabia's credibility, the confusion about the Iran sanctions, the expectation that oil was coming off the market that didn't really come off the market. One way or another, there's been a perfect storm of events that has moved crude oil prices dramatically down, but it did not move natural gas prices at the same time. They didn't move down. So if what's happening is you're long crude oil and you're doing that with leverage because you're short natural gas and you're expecting those two to move in unison in sympathy with one another and to hedge each other, and crude oil goes down dramatically and natural gas doesn't move, you're getting killed on the long side of your trade. What you have to do there is to cover that by selling crude oil. That just makes the crude oil go down even more. But you have to buy natural gas futures in order to cover your short. So you've already got a situation where the spread is too wide between them. And now in order to get out of that trade, is a lot of people have this trade on when they're all panicking and they reach their maximum pain point. They're all unwinding it at the same time. And it's that unwind that causes the spreads to just go crazy. And the reason I think you're seeing that action in the March-April is probably because there were a whole lot of people that were very, very short the March contract, and they are now buying it. They're buying to cover their short positions, and that is pushing the price of March up dramatically higher than the subsequent months that don't have to be covered.
Well, it'll be really interesting to see how long it takes for this to all cover and then what kind of a mean reversion happens afterwards. That's always one of the phenomena of the liquidity that is associated with all markets. Nonetheless, I want to move on to gold. And obviously, we were looking and continuously asking the question whether gold can break that 1245 level that was first talked about with Charlie when he was on our show. But really, here we are, gold dropped down back to 1200. We're bounced off of there, we're like 1213 at the time of recording. But we're back into that range that we spent more or less a good chunk of September and early October in. Are we back into like a gold purgatory here? Or what's the chance that we're going to still go higher? What's your feeling here?
Well, definitely, if you look at the gold chart in isolation, you really have to look at it and say, maybe this was an anomaly that started for who knows what reason on October 11th. We had that big unexpected move that got some people excited, self-reinforcing for a while, then it faded and it's moved back down. So if you just look at the gold chart by itself, it seems like, yeah, whatever happened there is over. But wait a minute. I still think there's more to this picture, because if you had asked me a couple of months ago, Eric, we're going to have the dollar index hit 97.5 and close there, where's gold going to be? I would have said between 1100 and 1150. And we're still holding above 1200. So when you look at the gold chart with consideration for how strong the dollar is, it really hasn't been as weak as you would expect it to be. So we did see something that started on October 11th and seems to have at least readjusted the level of things. Now we are trading back to what you would expect, which is inverse to the dollar index. It seems, though, that levels have been adjusted a little bit. So I think there is still something going on in gold, but for the moment, it looks like whatever that something is, it's gone dormant again.
I want to move on to the 10-year treasury yield, because we once again saw the yields jumping towards that 3.25 level. And it appears now, once again, we've rejected a breakout of that level. We're coming right back down. And I'm excited to hear this interview with Keith McCullough, because he's certainly been on that camp where he doesn't think yields are going much higher. And it'll be really interesting to see what he says when you interview him. But what's your take here? What's your thinking in terms of where yields are going?
Well, you're reading my mind, Patrick, because what a perfect guest to have this week. As you know, we've had so many voices on this program explaining so eloquently with such excellent arguments why the secular bond bear market is on, all uphill from here in terms of yield, downhill in terms of price. That's just the way it's going to be. And then sure enough, we went from, what was it, 325 on the 10-year as we were speaking last week, down to 3.10 earlier today. So you're seeing a dramatic change that most people were not expecting. What do you need? You need a guest on the program who's got a view which is opposite that consensus and can make an argument for why yields are actually already topped and headed lower from here. Keith will make exactly that argument. I'll let him make it so I don't steal his thunder, so to speak, but he makes a very eloquent argument that is opposite those that you've heard from other guests on the program. Before we move on, Patrick, I just want to mention for anybody who's interested, you, Patrick, are a speaker at the TD and TMX, which, of course, is the Options Exchange in Canada Option Education Day. That's online on November 21st. Free registration. The information is in the Research Roundup email.
Great. Thanks, Eric. So this week's featured interview guest is HedgeEye's founder, Keith McCullough. Eric's interview with Keith is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is HedgeEye founder Keith McCullough. Keith, it's been a year, I can't believe it, since we had you on the program. Last time that you were on, I think you were very much bullish, real growth, and there were a lot of naysayers saying the market was headed lower. You were adamant, and you were proven right. Now, things have changed, and we actually got a little bit of a heads up from your colleague, Darius Dale, when we had him on the program. He said, we are not firmly bullish anymore. We're starting to think twice. Now, as I look at slide 5 in your deck, it looks like you guys have moved into the fourth quad. So talk about the four quads, why you use them in your process, but particularly, how did we end up here underneath the neutral line in the fourth quad, and where is this headed?
Yeah, and I appreciate you recapping that, Eric, because, you know, being a bull or a bear permanently is no permanent position to take. And really, we've built the process, or I have over the course of the last long while, trying to use the two most causal things that change markets, which are the rates of change and growth and inflation, to get ahead of any change from bullish to bearish or bearish to bullish. And what you find is that there's always something to buy and there's always something to sell. So, you know, in our four quadrant map, as you can see there on slide 5, I think we're providing, everyone can see, you know, when you're in the first or second quadrant, those are pro-growth quadrants. You have growth accelerating. When growth and inflation are accelerating at the same time, interest rates go up, the Fed goes hawkish. That's why in the box there it says monetary policy bias is hawkish. So, you know, that's what we were set up for. And then really we were there for 9 quarters in a row, which, by the way, is a new U.S. record. The prior record was 7 quarters coming out of the early 1990s. And really, you had tax reform really provide the extra juice on top of that. And that's why we didn't stay bullish because of tax reform. We stayed bullish because the data that was born out of tax reform kept accelerating. So again, that's all I care about, is whether the data is accelerating or decelerating. And really, that's the point here, is that the call that we made in at the end of September was that we're changing, effectively flipping everything that we liked into things we don't like, and then doing the opposite with things that we didn't like, starting to get bullish on long-term bonds, bond proxies, because we're basically going to what we call the fourth quadrant. So the fourth quadrant, as you can see in that map, Q4 of 18, is a drastic shift from where we've been. And I'd say that the market's reaction at this point has actually been quite drastic, and it's in the right spots. I mean, typically when a market sniffs out that the economy is going into the fourth quadrant, they don't have to sniff out a recession or anything like that, which we'll get a lot of questions on. You just have to have the prevailing conditions of growth and inflation, which were tailwinds, become headwinds. And that's what's happened. The three worst places to be when that happens is momentum, high beta, and tech stocks. Tech stocks are obviously high beta and momentum, so it was all one and the same thing. And I think we're just in the early stages here of this correction on those in particular, those things that do the worst in the fourth quadrant.
Keith, I absolutely love your HedgeEye chart books, one of the best in the business. But for our long-term listeners, they've seen a lot of this. So I'm going to strongly encourage any new listeners to really spend some time on this chart book if you've never seen it before. Some of this, though, is boilerplate that our regular listeners have seen before. So I'm going to skip ahead to slide number 12, which is where we get back to your next current data outlook in terms of GDP forecasts. Talk us through, starting at slide 12, what you see on the horizon, where we're headed.
So, well, as I pointed out, like, you know, 9 quarters in a row, and again, I'd encourage everyone who hasn't done this before to acutely measure and map the data. These are facts, okay? The data that's released is a fact. You might believe the government made up the number, but the reality is that it's a made-up number versus the prior made-up number, so it's either accelerating or decelerating versus made-up numbers. But if you actually believe the numbers, which, you know, in this case I do, I believe that U.S. growth accelerated from, on slide 12 here, from 1.3% to 3%. It took 9 quarters. That's, again, a new U.S. record. And now the green bar, which is our forecast, this is a predictive tracking algorithm that we're dropping new data into the algo every time we get a new data point. is not only below Wall Street for the first time in, you know, really 6 to 9 quarters, but it's the first rate of change slowdown. Now, if you go to slide 13, how that reads to Wall Street is going to be a pretty violent move in GDP. So Wall Street doesn't look at the year over year. They look at the quarter over quarter seasonally annualized GDP number. If you don't know what that is, that'll be the number that gets released when GDP gets released. As you know, only because Trump was trumpeting it, 4.2 is the high number. A lot of pundits tried to tell you that there's sustainability to that. We told you that the next number was going to be 3.5. It actually ended up being 3.5. We got that one right on the screws. And now we're saying that if it just a modest slowdown year over year gets you a drastic sequential slowdown. And this is where the surprise factor really comes in. We're at 1.29% for GDP for Q4. That number is going to be reported in Q1. Okay. So I think not only, first of all, is it well below consensus, Wall Street consensus and the Atlanta Fed nowcast, but it also comes, Eric, right after the Fed rate hike. Because you get the rate hike in December, which we think they're going to do, and then you're going to get a big GDP negative surprise that's going to have, on the way to it, a bunch of numbers that continue to be revised to the downside in terms of high-frequency economic data points. So I think the market's going to see, or market participants, rather, are going to see what the market already sees. The market already sees what it sees. The market's always front-running us. If you don't know that, you're going to figure that out the hard way. And eventually, you end up with a data point that the market's already been discounting. And this is what I think is ultimately the number the market's looking at ahead to in January, even though it's only November.
So let's just put this in perspective, because you're talking, at least in your 1.29% figure, about a major, major miss on expectations, if you're right. Does that leave you outright short the market? And if you look at what's happened, you know, some people think that maybe we're going to see a bounce into year end. And if you wanted to get short, it's not time yet. Is it time to be short? And where do you see this going? Because I would think if you're proven right and the 1.29% comes true, we're going lower after that data comes out.
Yeah. I mean, and we're going lower into the number coming out. I mean, the news reconciles why we were going down. And the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, I've written multiple notes in the last 6 weeks saying, yes, I still believe what I believe. God forbid I believe what my model tells me. And it told me the same thing on the way up is that it's telling me on the way down. So at the same time, you should have conviction in a process and a model. So the key here, Eric, is, of course, selling the stuff that goes down the most. And, you know, whether it be tech, really on slide 8, we show you what it is. At the equity sector level, the calls to short on bounces, tech, industrials, and energy. Those are the three big short calls. And on the other side of it, what this model tells you to do is buy things that look like low beta or bonds or bond proxies. So it's buy utilities, buy REITs, buy consumer staples. So you don't have to be out of the market. You have to be out of the things that everybody else is long in the market, and you have to go buy the things that everybody else was underweight. So that's an easy thing for me to understand because, of course, I'm basically shorting the things that I liked and I'm buying the things I didn't like. You know, the next big part of this, I think, is on slide 14, especially on those bond proxies and long-term bonds. I know a lot of people are bearish on long-term bonds. There are a lot of you know, famous people that don't like bonds here. I'm not famous, but I didn't like bonds either. Now I do. And the main reason is because bonds over the course of the long term, intermediate to long term, tend to go where inflation's going. So our forecast on inflation, I'd say it's a layup, you know, by Q1 of 19, falling below 2%. We're at 1.76%. And that, of course, is a layup now because oil just crashed. So oil's the heaviest weight in that model. So I want to be acutely positioned for that. You know, you can obviously be long-term bonds if you're bearish on inflation. I think that Wall Street's going to come to us on that metric as well.
I really, really want to encourage our listeners, particularly newer listeners, to study the entire chart deck. And if you're not familiar with some of the HedgEye process, listen to Keith's interview from a year ago when we went into a lot of detail on this. But I'm going to go ahead and skip ahead again to slide 23, where we get into what you're actually looking for in terms of Q3 2018 macro themes. Walk us through these three themes and why they're important.
A theme's important when it's new, and then it starts to trend. So our call on the U.S. dollar, we called the dollar breakout in April, and then we reiterated in Q3 that the dollar should strengthen at this point, so we're going to stay with that in as much as shorting emerging markets on all bounces to lower highs. So again, if you're HedgEye power users, you know what to do. At the top end of the risk range, which we publish daily, that's where you make your sales. You don't sell them just because they're up. You sell them when they're up and at the top end of the range. So a good example of that, obviously, is the four-day U.S. equity bounce that we had coming out of the midterm election. And then we wrote a note that said huge selling opportunity. So again, that's what it is. Have interest rates peaked? I think that that's the biggest call left that has not yet worked in a meaningful way. But I do think that the 10-year bond yield is about to break. I just need it to break 305 on the 10-year yield. And I think there's a trap door underneath that towards 250 on the 10-year yield. And I don't think anybody else thinks it can go there. At least they haven't published that forecast. Maybe there is somebody. And if they want to be in my lonely corridor with me on that, then that's great. Quad 4 is the bigger theme, which is on slide 24. We're just rolling through.
Hey, hang on one second, Keith. One second before you go on. Let's come back to rates, because there is such a chorus of people that are just so convinced. Look, you saw the breakout past 3 spot 10, 312, whatever you want to call the magic number on the 10-year, got all the way up to 320-something, came back and retested that 312 level as support. It held, moved higher. There's so many people that just say, that's it. The secular bond bear market is upon us. Give us the rationale. Why do you disagree on a fundamental level with those views?
Well, one, the easiest way that I always disagree is that most people are just looking at a chart. I mean, there's a lot more to this than just looking at a chart. You know, anybody can look at what I affectionately call the 200-day moving monkey or the 50-day moving monkey. I mean, they're one-factor models. We get it. If you pull the chart back far enough on 10-year yields, you get almost every traditional technician is going to tell you it was a breakout in as much as every technician, Eric, as you know, told you that the Russell looked fine at the end of August, and so did the NASDAQ. Subsequently, they've both gone down on the order of 12 to 15%, and now the charts look bad. So that's the whole point of having a research process that front runs the turns in the technicals. And that's really when I look at it. I mean, I don't look at other people's technicals. I look at my own quantitative signal. And as I pointed out, as inflation data points come out lower, I think the Fed is going to go from hawkish to dovish. So I think they're going to raise rates for the last time in December. And if they continue raising rates during a quad four slowdown, then the markets, you know, the stock market's going to go down faster, and they're going to have to eventually cut rates faster anyway. So I really think that in the next 3 to 6 months, all my catalysts are really in the forward-looking outlook. And today, it would be very hard for people that don't agree with me to see those things, because people that see those things are just looking at a chart. And, you know, once they start to hear the Fed turning from hawkish to dovish, and then eventually I think the Fed's going to have to start cutting interest rates again, it'll be way too late to be buying long-term bonds. And that's effectively the point when I look at that. Another big thing that people call out is, of course, the gargantuan amount of Treasury issuance. You know, all the reasons why we could have given you to be bearish on bonds and bullish on bond yields for 2.5 years are clear. You know, bonds have been going down for 3 years, long-term bonds have, for a reason, and so is the short end of the bond market as well. I just think the cycle has peaked, again, on inflation, but also on growth and also on earnings. So the three-legged stool of peaks, called the triple peak, is the main reason why we have that outlook on bond yields going lower, making lower highs effectively from that 325, 323 level for now, for a year now, for that matter.
Okay, I cut you off on slide 24. Quad 4, again, for anybody who's not familiar with hedge-eye terminology, means we have both slowing growth and slowing inflation at the same time. Why quad 4? What does it tell us? And what's next as far as these themes on page 24?
Yeah, so quad 4 is simply summarized the way that you summarize it. So you have growth, you have inflation, both are now slowing in rate of change terms. So again, rate of change is the second derivative. That's what's going on, and that's what the market's trading on. Cyclical peaks in earnings, that's a really important one that we wanted to go through as well, just to highlight the moment of it all. But that lands squarely in conjunction with quad four. If you're in quad four and you think interest rates are done going up, then you'd probably start to buy something that went down because interest rates were going up. And that's, you know, why we like housing here. It's also playbook quad four long. So when you're in any quad, we have longs and shorts. You know, if I ran a broker dealer, maybe I'd make a lot more money or something like that, because we'd always have something for people to buy and to sell. But the reality is that these are based on historical returns by asset class, subsector exposure, like housing. Housing really only likes it when interest rates go up. And that shouldn't surprise anybody. And as much as it shouldn't surprise anybody that housing went down while interest rates were going up. So when interest rates go down, housing likes that. Of course, mortgage rates fall. And that's, you know, kind of personal. When you take all, you know, take the quad four theme, the other two themes are just extensions of that theme. And we go through a variety of different slides in this deck to the extent that you want to kind of dig into that.
Why don't we touch a little bit more on housing and be specific about what markets? Are we talking about U.S. housing specifically? Because obviously Canadian and Australian housing have got a lot of people's attention as potentially being bubbles. Housing in what markets are we talking about here?
Yeah, and I think I believe Josh Steiner, our housing analyst, has been with your listeners. You know, Cliff Notes' version of it is that he's been the bear on both Canada and Australian housing. So we have plenty of reasons to be bearish on those markets, on housing in particular in those markets. And those markets aren't the ones that I want to be bullish on. I want to be bullish on the one market in the world that has millennials. And millennials, of course, are the big household formation cohorts that are going to be buying houses in the next 3 to 5 years. In fact, there are, if you're 26 or 27 years old right now listening to this, you're one of 4.7 million in America that is going to be looking for a house in the next 3 to 5 years, ostensibly. So again, there's a big demand wave in the U.S. that's nowhere else in the world, certainly not on order of magnitude like this. It challenges the rate of change charts of the baby boom, 32 and 33 year olds, are about 4.4 million of those. So, you know, you have that, falling interest rates, you have easy comparisons also in the U.S. because this year was a terrible year for housing, and you have falling input costs. So, you know, the other side of our inflation slowing call, Eric, is that the input costs, like take a chart like lumber. Anybody who does macro across commodities knows that lumber has crashed. At one point in the year, it was up 63%, and now it's down 20. Okay, so the you got pretty much everything going for you a year out, maybe 6 months a year out, and Mr. Market's probably going to be front running you faster than that, and that's really like the summary on housing.
So when you say long housing, are we talking about as far as an actual trade? Are we talking about home builders? Are we talking about commodities like lumber? Where's the trade here specifically?
Home builders. So I'd be going with home builders, and eventually when the Fed goes dovish, Eric, I hope I get a chance to get on the blower with you again, because when the Fed goes dovish, I mean, I'm going to buy the living daylights out of things that are commodity related. That's what you do. That's the whole point of money printing. The Fed wants to resuscitate or reflate asset prices. And the best way to go to that, like, you know, directly to the vein, so to speak, and I'm not a pothead or a druggie or anything like that. I'm just telling you the best way to get the bang for your buck is to go to commodities. So if and when the Fed goes dovish, you'd probably reverse our dollar view, or I'll sell that book gains and buy commodities, which would include anything from lumber to crude oil. I mean, we're already on perdition's path, by the way, on crude oil. Quad 4 annihilates oil. For anybody who didn't know that, I guess now they know. But again, that's the whole point. Quad 4 is, you can substitute one word, it's called deflation. And so once you get through the deflation and the Fed realizes deflation's a risk, they try to devalue the dollar and reflate those assets. So it's fully loaded. So I'd like to buy commodities on a lag at some point next year, and emerging markets maybe at some point next year. But first, I'll just go with buying home builders or an index that reflects a basket of liquid U.S. listed home builders.
Let's continue with your slide deck on page 25. You're talking about comps. What are we comparing here?
Okay, so the base effects, that's the main component to our model that provides us a forward outlook that differentiates itself. So put simply, on a two-year basis, so when you look back, you can always add up 2 years and again, and divide, and you end up with a 2 year base effect. And as you can see, in Q2 of 18, the 1.7% number for US GDP was the easiest base effect of the entire period. Okay, so as we go forward, the base effect goes from 2.2 to 2.25 to eventually gets, at this time next year, 2.65. So the math is pretty simple if you get second derivative math, which is as the base effects steepen, and the data flows into steepening base effects, you get falling forward outlooks. And that's it. I mean, it's the same thing for comparative base effect model for inflation. By this time next year, you're going to be lapping extremely difficult comparisons for inflation. So that's why, and again, 78% of the time looking back at U.S. history, the forward outlook should reflect the opposite of what already occurred. And for those of you that want a quick lesson on base effects, it's back further in the deck. We provide some material on that. I don't write white papers on it, and I'm not going back to college to write a white paper. I'm just going to tell you that I already wrote the conclusion of the white paper, and that's what it is.
Keith, as I look to slide 26, I see a sea of color here moving from red on the left side to green on the right side. That must be a good thing. What's the important thing, though, to be watching? Where are the areas of concern on this chart?
For people that don't do rate of change, this is a quick way to get caught up. Like to your point, Eric, when it's all red, it's bad. When it goes from red to amber, it's less bad. When it goes to yellow, it's not so bad. And then when it goes green, it's obviously good. And when it's bright green, it's really, really good. As you'll note here, the aggregate of the U.S. economic acceleration really culminated in a bright green Q3 of 2018. But really, you can see color coding it by Q3, Q2, Q3 of 2019. we're back to yellow lights. And that's, if you're to just like see one picture and then line up the ducks on the biggest components of GDP and inflation, which is basically what we're showing here, that's the real point, is that the probable outcome is that we slow. Now, that's when I make calls. When the probable outcome is something that Wall Street's not positioned for, I want to obviously take that position. So again, if the lights were to change, Eric, and you know how I do this, I mean, if the lights were to change to in Q4 and Q1 of 2019, if they're to go bright green again, I mean, until I live in Moscow, reserve the unalienable right to change my mind and freedom to change my position. So I don't, this is kind of like this is a good example of how I use data dependence in its pure intensity to make decisions.
Well, as you said that, I started to say, what about the effect of the tariffs in terms of changing the color? And I see you've got it at the top of the next slide. You're reading my mind.
Well, you'll find that a lot of these slides come from, you know, we have a lot of institutional investors as clients, and they ask us obviously very good questions. So you're asking the right question because, you know, people will say, okay, look, aren't these tariffs inflationary? And the answer is yes, but are they inflationary in dollars? Okay. So China represents only 22% of U.S. imports. First of all, when you start doing the math, you start to come to some more specific conclusions as opposed to political or ideological ones. And really, you know, the dollar strength right now is offsetting any inflationary impact of tariffs. So again, when you show somebody what imports are on a reported basis, you have to report those in dollars. And the reality is that the dollar in Q1 of 18 was down 7% year over year. And now as you go into Q1 19, the dollar is going to be up 7%. So that's like that's the 1,400 basis point delta. And that's way more than what, you know, even if you fully tax all of Chinese imports, the full 25% that, you know, is bandied about, you still wouldn't have inflation on in dollars, like how you report it. So that's why it hasn't really bothered me in as much as like wage inflation would. And on slide 28, we kind of get into that too, just to kind of jump ahead to that, because those are the two big things, Eric, that people ask about. They're saying, okay, actually, we're bullish on wage inflation. We've had the highest wage inflation estimates on Wall Street all year long. I mean, so that's easy, but it's harder for people to say with tariffs and with wage inflation, how do I get a forward outlook of falling inflation? Well, falling headline inflation is actually quite consistent with rising wage growth, because wage growth is the last thing in the economic cycle to go up. And anybody who hasn't studied that hasn't studied cycles. I mean, on slide 29, you can see that too, where we show you headline inflation, which is CPIs, it goes down, dollars going up, and wages are going up, and you get a margin squeeze. Like this is, I don't know if you've looked at this chart before, Eric, but you have like in the red bars, you have the recessions, and the gray line is wages. The wages always accelerate into a recession. They perpetuate a recession. So the Fed sits there and they're too hawkish, too late. Wages are rising, they're tightening policy, and lo and behold, you end up getting a big red bar, and that's, you know, predominantly driven by rising wages and falling profits. One perpetuates the other, as you know.
Keith, moving on to slide 29, you're talking about a margin squeeze. I'm assuming that's a profit margin squeeze and not a margin interest, as in borrowing on margin squeeze. How does this fit into the story? Because a lot of people have said, you know, we've got great profits. Why would they be squozing suddenly?
At the end of every economic cycle, you get spiking wage growth. So that's the beginning of the end. All of the time. Okay. So that's where you get a red bar, and that's slide 29. Wages are rising faster than profits have, because over time, profits can't go up forever. What's interesting about this, of course, is that wages in this cycle are coming off the all-time lows, whereas in every other cycle, they are high and rising to begin with. So a dramatically different setup for people to be concerned about from a margin squeeze perspective. If you take this down to the studs on slide 30, what we're showing here are the rates of change again. Classically, or at least from our perspective, this is all we look at is rate of change. Year-over-year earnings growth had accelerated in something like technology, fourth row from the bottom here in this chart, to 32% growth in Q2 of 18. That was the top, all right? So actually, if all you did was, as a bottom-up investor, pick stocks that had accelerating sales and earnings growth and they were tech stocks, you crushed it. But then if you didn't sell them when the slowdown began at the end of the third quarter in the current reported season to 26.6%, and then it's going to be lower the quarter after that, and the quarter after that, and the quarter after that, then you got body bagged. So you don't want to do that, okay? So it's not about the level of earnings growth. It's about the rate of change of earnings growth. And we've proven this out empirically. So at the end of the day, not enough people understood or believed this into the end of the summertime, but now they're starting to ask the right questions on whether or not rate of change slowdowns in earnings can perpetuate, you know, broadly lower stocks. And the reality is on slide 31, 100% of the time, that's what happens. Like, so if we get this is showing you the margin, the operating margin for the S&P 500 and the three tops you could have bought stocks at before you get body bagged. Getting body bagged isn't very good. When the margins go down, the stocks go down. And even if you only look at this coming out of the 2015 top of the S&P's operating margins to the 2016 low, the average decline in there, Eric, was 38% in the Russell 3000, like the broadest swath of U.S. stock. The average decline by stock was 38%. So I think that this sucker is going down. Like, this red line is going down. The easiest way to make it go down is the dollar going up first. Secondly, it's wages. So really slides 29, 30, and 31, they go together. And there's no case to be made in U.S. stock market history, which is different than U.S. economic history. U.S. economic history, everybody's like, oh my God, until you tell me there's a recession, I'm not going to be scared. And then, by the way, you know, guys like me are going to tell you to buy stocks during the recession, because that's what you do. You buy stocks after the red line on slide 31 goes down. And that's just a fact. I don't know how anybody could debate it at this point.
Moving on to slide 32, the Shanghai Accord, supposedly to control appreciation of the dollar. I remember there being a lot of talk about that. I'm not sure it was ever substantiated beyond theory. Where does the Shanghai Accord come into this story? And perhaps more importantly, what about the whole narrative of China growth slowdown and how that could affect other markets and contagion risks that exist there?
Well, that's like, you know, it's at the end of this presentation, but it really should have been at the beginning. I mean, the beginning of the economic slowdown, Eric, in 2018 started with China slowing. So, again, good time series folks have to go backwards and say, where did China accelerate against now where we're already slowing? It started with the Shanghai Accord. Now, the Shanghai Accord, for those of you that don't know, on the left side, we're showing during the deflationary scare of early 2016, this is Janet Yellen going dovish. Okay, so the line's going down because she wants to devalue the dollar. And again, going dovish, that's what happens, and resuscitate asset prices. Particularly, she got that obviously in the resource space. So at the same time that the Fed's going dovish and the dollar's going down, on the right side, you see the Chinese providing the largest stimulus in the history of China. Okay, that's why they call it the Shanghai Accord. You know, the largest stimulus in the history of China is obviously a very long time. So you can see that when the Fed and the Chinese are stimulating at the same time, it's like Marty McFly might not know that stocks are and risk assets are going to go up. But anyone who's done this for any period of time should know that. And that's exactly what happened. So you ended up with this massive acceleration in the part of the Chinese economy that they, as communists, can command and control, which includes heavy construction, empty cities, again, very cyclical stuff. So if you got too bearish in the lows of 16 on empty cities in China, you made a drastic mistake because you underestimated that a communist was trying to get reelected for life. And that's really what we call, in conjunction with the Shanghai Accord, we call it really Xi's magic trick. I mean, the guy got elected for life. If you go to the next slide, actually on slide 33, if you take secondary industries, as I pointed out, like the heavy stuff, construction, et cetera, in China, the blue line went from 0% growth in late 2015 and early 2016, it got to 1. Then they stimulated and it went to 14% growth. 14% growth, to put that in context, was 50% almost 47%, almost 50% of China's GDP growth. Okay. And you wonder why the world went into a globally synchronized recovery and why, you know, it was easy to be bullish. Even a guy like me could have been bullish, because you had a globally synchronized recovery that was backstopped by the Chinese and the Fed devaluing, and then Trump did tax reform. So it's like the best growth story you could possibly imagine. But now that's a comparison. So now the Chinese have to lap that. That's why I show that in the slide 33. This is the most important chart that I think that this is all about awareness. What are the base effects? What are the comparisons? What happened? What are we trying to compare against? And again, as you go from ignorance to awareness, you come up with the revelation that the Chinese are going to continue to slow because they only have steepening base effects or tougher comps all the way into the end of Q1 19. By the way, Q2 19 isn't exactly an easy comparison at 11.6%. I'm talking about the black bars in that chart. So I think that no matter what, and this is, what to hear your thoughts on this or anyone else's thoughts. A lot of people think that, you know, Trump is going to magically tweet that he likes the Chinese or they're having good discussions or whatever. I really don't think there's anything he can do to get the Chinese to accelerate against the biggest stimulus in the history of China. It's just math. And I think that that's actually one of the biggest kind of trap doors in the market, is if you're looking for Trump in a tweet to save you on tariffs, I think you're looking for the wrong thing.
Fantastic chart deck, as usual, Keith. I want to touch on something outside of this, though. We've had Charlie McElligott from Nomura on the program recently, and he talks quite a bit about the modeling that they do, where they basically anticipate at what levels are the trend-following CTAs going to change their allocation. So nobody's making any kind of, you know, rational decision. It's just at a certain level on various different markets, things tend to accelerate. And Charlie was incredibly prescient at predicting if we got to certain levels on this S&P sell-off that it would accelerate to the downside, and that's exactly what happened. So I'm seeing a lot of credibility to these models that are not based on anybody having an opinion about the economy. It's just when you get to a certain level, the machines are going to do this, and it's going to cause a panic, and that's going to result in that and the other thing. And these predictions seem to be coming true. Is this a big risk in the market? And how do you factor that into your very fundamental-driven viewpoint in everything that you do in your analysis?
I agree with that 100%, that has a big impact, and it is perpetuated by these factors that are fundamental that I've been talking about. So I spent most of the time talking about our fundamental research process, but on our quantitative signaling process, which runs, you know, side by side, I'd come up with the very similar observations, and I call it the machine. So again, the machine, or especially if you look at equities, so it's an interesting call by the gentleman at Nomura, because the equity market really is the most obvious place to see this happening. 90% of daily trading is systematic trading, rules-based trading. So again, anyone who's systematic or rules-based doesn't care about what the company's PE is, what the company does, if you like Apple or not. It has to do with the rules of the quantitative system. So if you start to break, and really what you can observe quite quickly, if you break 1 month price momentum in anything to the downside or the upside, and this works both ways, that's why it's very relevant. It also perpetuated the squeezes we saw in the FANG, you know, into the summertime highs, or momentum over growth, et cetera, et cetera. These are all factor exposures that the machines are chasing. And the machines will chase it and chase it and chase it until the factor that's causing it changes. So I think that that's easily the thing that's making things happen faster and faster, is that, you know, you have $2 trillion that's being managed by the quants, I mean, pure rules-based quants. Then you have the pod shops, and I'm not going to name names, but you know who they are, and they're delta hedging constantly. And then you just have people that have no idea that are just chasing charts. I mean, which are also a large constituency of people. So it's a really bad thing on the downside, in as much as it's a great thing on the upside. So I think this thing goes both ways. And the main thing is that the volatility to predict these moves, or at least run, you know, side by side with our fundamental research view. And I think it's a glaring market risk to the downside right now.
Well, Keith, I can't thank you enough, and particularly you and your colleagues at HedgEye, for putting together another fantastic chart deck. Your chart decks are always excellent. We always appreciate them. I very much encourage our listeners to check out all the slides that we skipped, because they are very much relevant. I just wanted to focus on the content that our longtime listeners have not heard before. I do want to come to this time of year. You guys at HedgEye have all kinds of different research products. If you were to sign up for all of it, it's about $2,700 a year. So it's great stuff, but it's not cheap. Once a year, and only once a year, our friend Dan Holland puts together a very special offer. It's a huge discount, and it ends up being basically $1,000 to get access to everything. Macro Voices is the only, I'm told, partner that you have that Patrick managed to actually talk Dan down another $100. So it's $899 for the all access pass. So who is that for, and how much time do they need to dedicate to it in order to fully benefit from what's on offer there?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate your audience and your listeners. And we really couldn't, and it's obviously true, we're not giving this to anybody else in terms of a promotion, because you have to be somebody who is interested in developing a macro process. I mean, Macro Voices, of course, spans all different segments of what people could be interested in from a global macro analysis perspective, whether it be quantitative or fundamental research. And, you know, we have a lot of components to our process when it comes to that, that are surgically analyzing, measuring and mapping macro, you know, so you can't just do it with one product. And if you want to develop a process like mine, I'm effectively trying to get people to use my process, whether to just augment what it is that they're doing, or to, again, complement a component of what it is they're doing, or just borrow the whole darn thing. And in that case, you need all the products. And to your point, Eric, I think a lot of people would say that the price point to that is too high. That, where that's born out of is that 90% of my business is institutional investors, where the price point is well ahead of that level. So we're doing our best to give, you know, people that are really, that really want to get good at this, the right access to the right products and the right information. That's why, you know, putting it all in a bundle makes it all the better.
Well, I couldn't agree more that the bundle is very much a bargain at $8.99. It was a bargain, frankly, at $9.99. This is for somebody who really wants to learn about a formal investment process, how to trade your own accounts the way that a hedge fund or other professional investor would trade theirs. All of this information is linked in your Research Roundup email. Keith, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was really great to have Keith back on the show. It really resonates with my style of macro thinking to look at his view of that we're in this supposed quad four. Everyone is really hyping this idea that inflation's about to run away. I just personally don't see it that way. And it's really interesting. You know, a lot of the things that Keith was talking about jive really well with the way I'm looking at the world. So it's interesting to see that someone else is thinking the same things that I am. Nonetheless, what did you take away from the interview?
You know, I thought it was really just a delight to have a credible opposing view. We've had so many people on the program that are just convinced that the mega bear market in bonds is on and it's all over and it's all downhill in price, uphill in yield from here. And to hear Keith make an intelligent, well-stated argument in the opposite direction really provides a good contrast. And sure enough, you know, what we're seeing, we were at 3.10 earlier in the day today on Thursday, back up to 3.11 now on the 10-year, and actually just clicked to 3.12 as I was speaking. So, you know, it seems like we are still undecided on where this yield thing is going, and I don't really have a firm opinion on who's right. What I do have a firm opinion on is it's the most important thing to watch. I think a whole lot of people in this market are assuming that the bond bear market is on and that yields are headed considerably higher in coming months. And if that proves wrong, it's going to breathe a sigh of relief into the market. And particularly if Keith's view is right and we get back down and clear 260 to the downside, which has been a major support level in yields. And if prices continue to rally beyond that, that really is going to be a game changer for a number of people's assumptions. So in terms of the psychology of how people are trading, I think that most of the market is assuming yields go much higher. And so to hear Keith's opposing view as to why they may actually be headed lower, I thought was the most fascinating part of the interview.
Eric, let's talk about your new book. I think you surprised a lot of people because for a long time, it seemed like you were a huge skeptic of this cryptocurrency trend. Yet all of a sudden, you're writing a book about the subject. What happened here? Did your thinking on the subject change? And why did you write this particular book right now at this particular time? Especially now that in the last 48 hours, as the book is being released, Bitcoin's down 1,000 points in 48 hours. What's your thinking?
Well, I didn't know Bitcoin would be down 1,000 points on the particular day the book came out. But frankly, that was one of the predictions in the book, is that cryptocurrencies would continue to sell off. And I guess the real answer is the book is not about cryptocurrency and it's not about blockchain. But it does reflect an evolution on my thinking on the subject, because what I realized is I was making a huge mistake. And frankly, I think almost everyone else in finance has made that same mistake. That mistake is failing to separate the invention of digital cash from the cryptocurrency trend of the last several years and to think about them as separate issues. The inventions of distributed ledger and double spend-proof digital cash are game changers, Patrick. They offer the opportunity to profoundly improve the global monetary system, and the benefits are extraordinary. What the book explains is why digital currency is certain to change the world, and the central prediction of the book is that the U.S. dollar will eventually be replaced as the global reserve currency by a digital global reserve currency. On the other hand, the whole cryptocurrency trend of the last decade really amounts to libertarian privacy activists using these inventions before anybody else did in order to coin their own money. In other words, to do something that has not been allowed for thousands of years of monetary history. But they've been getting away with it, at least so far. Now, as a fellow libertarian, I love the concept of privately issued money competing with government-issued money. But I'm also a realist, and I know that in this day and age, the odds of governments allowing cryptocurrencies to advance to the level of competing with central bank issued money systems is extremely low. So as I detail in the book, the common belief in the crypto community that governments are somehow powerless to outlaw cryptocurrency simply isn't true. Governments have yet to wake up to the true threat that cryptocurrency poses to them. And my prediction is that when they do, cryptocurrencies will face an existential challenge. Now, is the market starting to figure this out and that's the reason it's selling off, or is it something else? I'm not sure. But the mistake that I was making all along, and that just about everyone else was making, is to lump digital currency and cryptocurrency together. They're really separate ideas. Digital currency technology is a breakthrough, which I am convinced will change the world that we live in. Cryptocurrency is an experiment to see how long libertarian privacy activists can get away with coining their own money before central bankers wake up and figure out what's going on. The really big connection that most people in finance are failing to make is between digital currency technology and the U.S. dollar's status as the world's global reserve currency. What we're seeing more and more, Patrick, is that foreign governments are expressing outrage at U.S. foreign policy, which they allege effectively weaponizes the world's global reserve currency and turns it into a tool of coercive influence for imposing unilateral sanctions on countries like Iran and Venezuela. So a major theme of the book, Patrick, is connecting those dots and explaining why the evidence shows that Russia and China have already figured out that being first to market with a state-sponsored global-scale digital currency system could give them exactly the edge they need in order to displace the dollar as the world's global reserve currency. So it's not a book about cryptocurrency, and it's not a book about blockchain. The whole point of the book is to look beyond blockchain and to look beyond the current generation of cryptocurrencies and examine how the inventions of digital cash and distributed ledger are likely to change the world that we live in the long term. And I predict that it's going to be a profound change. By profound, I mean on the scale of the internet or the personal computer. So I really think that digital currency is going to be a really, really big deal. I'm still very skeptical, Patrick, that cryptocurrencies will play anything close to as big of a role in this story as the crypto community is assuming that they will. But I try to keep an open mind to all of the possibilities. So there's an entire chapter that's dedicated to what it would actually take for a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin to eventually evolve to the point of being able to serve as a significant currency in the global monetary system.
Okay, so the book isn't really about cryptocurrency. It's about digital currency and why cryptocurrency, as we know it today, is just one of the possibilities with respect to how the world will eventually come to embrace digital currency technology. Well, that makes a lot more sense, but I'm still curious to understand, why did you decide to make this the topic of your first book, and why did you decide to write it now?
Because I've become passionate about helping the world to recognize that we've all been making a huge mistake by lumping digital currency technology and cryptocurrency together. A whole lot of very smart people made exactly the same mistake that I made. They evaluated digital currency generally on the basis of how realistic the prospects of cryptocurrency like Bitcoin are to take over the global monetary system. They correctly concluded that the odds of governments allowing private issue cryptocurrencies to compete meaningfully with major global currency systems are infinitesimally small. But then they made a huge mistake. they threw the baby out with the bathwater and they wrote off digital currency entirely. That's a huge mistake. So my message to the global finance community is that the antiquated fractional reserve banking system is already in severe need of an overhaul. Digital currency offers an opportunity to advance the system in profound ways while opening the door to re-engineering the entire fractional reserve system to make better use of technology. We need to take this opportunity seriously. And the reason it's so important that we do is China and Russia have already figured this out. It's a competitive game. And the sovereign nation or nations that are first to market with a global scale digital currency system are going to have the opportunity to seize the title of global reserve currency away from the US dollar. So the goal of the book is to change the topic of conversation and to recognize that digital currency and cryptocurrency are two separate things that we need to be thinking about separately.
All right. Tell us a little bit more about the structure of the book and what people can expect to learn from reading it.
I start with a review of what money itself is, comparing commodity, representative, and fiat money systems that have existed throughout history. And I include an analysis of the shortcomings and risks inherent to fiat currency. This is essential because it really doesn't make sense to learn about digital currency until you first understand monetary history in context, how we got onto a global fiat money standard to start with, and what the risks are that are inherent to that system. Then I provide an introduction to both the culture and the technology of cryptocurrency, where it came from, and the motivations and ideology of its inventors. I introduce Bitcoin to illustrate the capabilities of a cryptocurrency, but only at an overview level. This is not a book about Bitcoin or about cryptocurrency, and I only cover Bitcoin in sufficient detail to explain how it fits into a much bigger overall picture. From there, we take a deep dive on monetary theory, with 8 full chapters explaining a whole bunch of essential monetary theory concepts. You can't have a meaningful conversation, Patrick, about how a digital currency is someday going to replace the US dollar as the world's global reserve currency unless you first have a really solid understanding of money supply and fractional reserve banking, private credit expansion, monetary policy tools, and what it actually means for a currency system to serve as the global reserve currency in the first place. So after a whole bunch of monetary theory, I then return to digital currency and consider what it would take for an existing cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin or Ethereum to advance to become a major global currency system. And I explain that there are serious challenges to overcome before that could actually happen, before a cryptocurrency could serve in that role. And I analyze what it would take to overcome those challenges. There's also a chapter that outlines the advances in digital currency technology that have been pioneered by various different cryptocurrencies, such as Ethereum and Monero and so forth. One of those advancements, called smart contracts, gets an entire chapter unto its own because it is so critically important in the long-term outlook for digital currency technology. Then finally, I tie it all together with several chapters that lay out my own vision of where I think digital currency technology is headed, including a detailed description of what I'm calling a digital sovereign bond market, which I see as a critically important ingredient in this story.
Okay, let's focus on your concept of the digital sovereign bond market, since that's a unique subject that nobody else is writing about. Please elaborate, why is a digital sovereign bond market important, and how does that play into the story?
Well, Patrick, the critical question to ask yourself is, how is it even possible that the US dollar is still the world's reserve currency, considering it's been more than 4 decades since President Nixon abandoned the gold peg and effectively defaulted on the Bretton Woods Treaty, which had established the dollar as the global reserve currency in the first place? And how is it possible that the dollar retains that title to this day, even when so many governments around the world are expressing outrage over U.S. foreign policy with regard to the dollar? The answer to that question is simple. The dollar retains reserve currency status precisely because there simply is no viable alternative to the U.S. Treasury bond market for central reserve assets. So it's actually the sovereign bond market, which is the critical link in this chain, that is allowing the dollar to retain its reserve currency status. As I explain in detail in the book, Central bank reserve assets is just a fancy name for the piggy bank of an entire nation. It's the emergency money that they have set aside in case they should ever need to defend their own currency in a crisis. That means they need to hold something that they can sell in size in a hurry during a financial crisis and still find plenty of liquidity in the market. Nothing beats U.S. Treasury bonds for that mission, and everybody knows it. But there's a very important assumption that everybody's making. They assume that the only way another reserve asset could ever compete with U.S. Treasuries is if it had comparable market capitalization. They make that assumption because they're presuming that market capitalization is the primary determinant of market depth and liquidity. But that's simply not true. We know from the advances that have occurred in modern equity markets, they've already shown that liquidity rebates can be used to incentivize providers of liquidity in the stock market. Now, that's one very simple example of how technology has changed the market mechanism rather than the underlying security itself in order to enhance market liquidity. So as I explain in a chapter that's dedicated entirely to this subject, I envision a digital sovereign bond market, which is designed from the ground up to use technology for the express purpose of not just matching, but beating the appeal of the U.S. Treasury market, specifically for use as central bank reserve assets, designing a market that meets the needs of the central bankers. And my contention is, if you achieve that goal, to provide central bankers with a superior reserve asset through market technology superiority rather than through market capitalization brute force, I contend you could easily displace the U.S. dollar as reserve currency. And I'm also convinced that Russia and China have already figured this out.
Who's the target audience, and what is it that they can expect from the book?
Well, it's written to appeal to several target audiences. First of all, anyone who's interested in the future of the global monetary system will learn why digital currency is going to be incredibly important, regardless of whether cryptocurrency takes over the world or is outlawed completely next week. Separate issue. The real point is to understand how profound an opportunity exists to modernize the global monetary system. Digital currency is just one of several digital technologies that come into play, but I predict that it's the one that will be the catalyst to lead to adoption of several others. The global finance community needs to wake up to something China and Russia figured out a long time ago. Digital currency will be the weapon of choice in challenging dollar hegemony over the global financial system. Once you recognize that that's what's going on here, a whole lot of other things fall into place and become clear. So that's the first audience. The next audience is cryptocurrency fans. Some of them won't like the fact that I'm not predicting that their cryptocurrencies are going to take over the global financial system as easily as so many people in the crypto community assume that they will. But frankly, intelligent, mature investors always want to hear the counter argument to anything that they're investing in. So my message to cryptocurrency owners who are certain that digital currency is the way of the future is twofold. First, you're right. Digital currency is going to change the world profoundly. And the more you learn about it, the better off you're going to be. But the second message is not to assume that your cryptocurrency tokens are necessarily going to appreciate as this revolution occurs. It may not be cryptocurrencies that are the digital currencies of the future. I try to take a positive approach, though. So instead of naysaying cryptocurrency, I try to offer a realistic understanding of what the actual challenges are that need to be overcome in order for cryptocurrency to achieve the goals that so many people in the crypto community have set for cryptocurrencies. And I provide the needed understanding of monetary concepts such as Triffin's paradox, which are essential to understanding what it would take for a cryptocurrency to replace the dollar as the world's global reserve currency. Finally, the last target audience is governments and their central bankers, who will find my commentary very critical of their actions to date, and particularly for their failure to act. I hope to impress upon them that while they may not yet have woken up to the reality that this is a competitive game and that the nation or nations who are first to market with a global-scale digital currency system will gain tremendous advantage over the rest of the world, while they may not have figured that out, Russia and China most assuredly already have. The West is behind and risks being upstaged. Western governments need to wake up and recognize what China and Russia are already up to, which is using digital currency technology as a tool to threaten the dollar's hegemony over the global financial system.
Now, Eric, the book is available in paperback, on Kindle, and in audiobook formats. We're going to release the first chapter of the audiobook as a free sample to MacroVoice listeners who can find that free sample in their regular iTunes feed or on the homepage of macrovoices.com. Tell us a little bit more about your plans for the book launch and how our loyal fans can help.
Well, frankly, I really need your help, folks. I'm passionate about changing the topic of discussion across the entire industry to something more meaningful and getting the finance community to recognize the importance of digital currency completely independent of cryptocurrency. We need to stop thinking about them as the same thing. Books like this are only successful in capturing the attention of an entire industry if they're able to gain momentum. And frankly, that comes from media appearances. So my request to our listeners is any help that you can possibly give me in landing more media opportunities to promote the book, both on other podcasts as well as traditional media such as talk radio or any other kind of media that you might have access to, it would be tremendously appreciated. I can assure you from our own experiences producing MacroVoice that requests from our listeners carry 1,000 times more weight than an author emailing us telling us why we should interview him about his new book, because there's lots and lots of those emails. So if you agree with me that it is important for the finance community to start separating digital currency technology from cryptocurrency, please help by tweeting, emailing your podcast host friends, media hosts, whatever it is, anything you can do to help me get the word out about this book, I would tremendously appreciate it. As Patrick said, we're putting the first full chapter of the audiobook out as a free sample. That will give you a better sense of what the book is about. You should already have that in your iTunes feed by the time you hear this interview, or if you're not subscribed, you can find it at macrovoices.com. So I hope you enjoy it, and for those of you who decide that you want to buy the book, I really hope that you'll consider writing an Amazon review after you've read it. On that note, we need to leave it there for this week's show. As always, we appreciate your help promoting MacroVoices by forwarding your research roundup emails and telling your friends and colleagues about us. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup email.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Keith, as well as the link to the chart book that Eric and Keith referenced throughout the interview. You'll also find an interesting video interview with Fed Chair Jerome Powell on global perspectives, as well as a Financial Post video interview with David Rosenberg, where he discusses the Canadian economy and the central bank policy in Canada. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.